I'm going to take a page out of the Chuck Ford playbook tonight and move down close here because our lesson tonight is going to be more in a class format, a more informal format. So we're going to be looking tonight at some passages in Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15, so if you'd like to be opening your Bibles there. We're going to be looking at particularly starting in verse 11, one of the parables that Jesus gives. Now this parable is one that we typically or traditionally call the prodigal son. But as you look at the actual parable, Jesus doesn't call it that, and it's really something of a misnomer. There are two sons in this parable. Look at chapter 15 of Luke, verse 11. Jesus starts out there and it says, he said, a man had two sons. So this is really a parable about two sons that Jesus wants us to look at and to compare and contrast. And if we don't do that, if we just focus on the one son that we normally think of, the prodigal son, then we're only getting half of the truth that Jesus is seeking to deliver here in this parable. So let's just start out and let's read the parable through, and then we'll go back and talk about it more specifically. Chapter 15, verse 11. And he said, a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. But when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he got up and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his slaves, quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fattened calf, kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. Now, his older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring what these things could be. And he said to him, your brother has come. And your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, look, for so many years I have been serving you and I have never neglected a command of yours. And yet you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live and was lost and has been found. So this parable then, we see these two sons, the younger one, and the older one, and as we start out with Act One, if you will, of this story, and that concerns the lost younger son. And I'd like to focus particularly as we go through this, thinking about the original hearers of this parable. You know, those people back in the New Testament times. Because much of what Jesus says here to them would have been very shocking, very out of place, very, very radical. And because this is a familiar passage to us, some of that edge, I think, is taken off of it for us. But think of it in terms of the people that were living back there. We'll say more about that as we go along. But again, now going back and looking first of all at the first act, if you will, of this story, he introduces a man who has two sons, and this story moves very quickly. We find, first of all, the younger son comes to the father, and he says to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me." Now, again, we're familiar with the story. We know that happens, but that would have been absolutely shocking to people back then. And actually, this would be pretty shocking if it happened today. A man's children back in those days, his sons, anybody know how the estate would be divided? Let's say there's two sons, just two sons mentioned here. How would the estate be divided? Jeff? Okay, older son would... Okay. But, yeah, when the estate was eventually divided, the older son would get a double portion, and the younger son would get what was left. And so here, if you're thinking about the estate, two-thirds would go to the older brother, one-third would go to the younger son. So we have the younger son here coming to the father and saying, "I'd like one-third of your estate, if you please." Now, what is it particularly unusual about that? Okay, he's not dead yet. That's interesting, and of course that would be shocking to them. It would also be shocking to us. This society in which this story is being given, of course, by Jesus was a very patriarchal society. The father, without question, was the head of the family, the extended family. That's another difference from today. The father and his sons and their wives and so forth would tend to live in the same location, if not the same house. And so it was a different sort of a social situation here. But, it wasn't typical to get your inheritance before the father died. And as you look at various commentators and so forth, you know, really, what is the younger son saying here? Younger son is saying, in essence, "Father, my relationship with you is just been a means to an end. You know, I want your stuff. I don't want you. So please give me my share of your estate." And in essence, what the younger son is saying here is, "Father, I wish you were dead. I wish that's where you were right now, and then I wouldn't have to even ask. It would just be given to me." But he wants it early, so he has to ask his father. But one thing we perhaps don't recognize, unless we think about it, is how insulting that would have been to this father. Absolutely insulting, as the head of this household, to tell him, "I really don't want to be under your control. I don't want to be under your authority. I want your stuff. I don't want you." A great disrespect to the father in asking for what he asked for. And the typical response of a typical father in that time, what do you think would have been to such a request? "No way. No way. That's totally inappropriate. That's insulting." Probably would have driven the son out of the house and say, "You get lost. You're not getting anything. I'm writing you out of the will." That's what a typical father, how a typical father would have responded. But interestingly, how did this father respond to that request? He said, "Okay. Okay." It says, so he divided his wealth between them. Now, that word wealth there is interesting. It actually comes from a Greek word, bios, which is the word, of course, for life. So he divided his living, his livelihood, among them. Back in that time, as well as being a patriarchal society, having extended families, it also was a very agrarian sort of existence for most families. You know, you were on a farm, you were on an estate. This obviously is a wealthy farm situation, this estate, but still, your wealth and your standing in the community would be in your land and in your livestock, the amount of livestock you had, the amount of land that you had. And so here, to grant this request and divide his life, his living, such that his son could get his share early, what would the father have had to do at that point? He would have had to sell off part of his estate. He would have had to sell off his land. He would have maybe had to sell some of his livestock. He would have to liquidate that to give this younger son his request of, the one-third of the estate that fell to him. And again, back in that time, that would have been an extremely humiliating thing for a father to have done. And probably others in the community would have said to him or thought about him that, he's making a big mistake there. He shouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't do that. But this father is different. This father does divide the estate. So the younger son gets his wish. He doesn't want to be home anymore. He doesn't want to be under the father's authority. And so he takes what he has. He goes, it says in verse 13, not many days later, so a short time, young son gathers everything up and he goes off to where? A distant country. He gets far away from his home situation, far away from the authority of the father, where he can do things without somebody looking over his shoulder. So he goes to this far country, and Jesus makes rather short work of his life there. It says, and he squandered his estate with loose living. So he's just wild with his money. He spends it left and right on all sorts of things that are not good, and pretty soon it's gone. It just disappears, like sand running through his fingers, and it's gone. And then, as we read, there's a severe famine that occurs. So not only did he run out of money, but now the whole economic system of the area is in distress because of this famine. And so it's not easy for him to find work anymore. He can't just go out and get a job and earn money to keep up with the lifestyle that he had thought he wanted here. And he becomes impoverished, it says. So he goes and he hires himself out. He finally finds a job with somebody. And again, another thing about this story is Jesus, of course, is a Jew telling this story to Jewish people. And the job that this person gets is what? Feeding pigs. Why would that be disturbing to a Jewish person? Okay, pigs were unclean animals. They weren't to eat them. They weren't to have contact with them. And so this was about as low as you could get in terms of employment. He would have presumably been working for a Gentile, too, who was owning these pigs. So he found himself having to go hire himself out to do this terrible job, and pretty soon he's down in the pigsty. He's feeding them these husks, and he's so hungry he's dreaming about eating these husks rather than feeding them to the pigs. So he's in a very dire situation. So obviously his plan of this exciting life that he thought he wanted hasn't worked out too well. It's just gone downhill, and he finds himself in the mud. And finally, in verse 17, as we read, get to the next act in the play, and that is, it says he comes to his senses. He finally, realizes, I thought I wanted to go off and be on my own. I thought I wanted to make my own decisions. I thought I wanted to be my own authority, make my own rules, decide how I'm going to live and be free of my father's influence or direction. But he suddenly realizes that he had it pretty good where he was. And he needs to go back there. And so he comes to his senses. He says, he remembers his father's hired men, those that worked for his father, and how they had enough to eat. They had money that they were earning. And compared to them, he's in dire straits. He can't feed himself anymore. And so he decides to come up with this sort of restitution plan. He realizes he's made a big mistake here. He's lived in a way that's not right. He's wasted all of what he asked from the father. So he finally decides, I'm going to go back and I'm just going to offer myself as a hired man to my father. And I'll try to pay him back. I'll try to earn my way back into his good graces. I'll try to become a member of his family again. And obviously, at this point in the story, he's come to realize and come to be humbled by his situation. Verse 19, he says, I'll say to my father, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired men. So that's his restitution plan. He decides, I'll go back and I'll make this offer to my father and see what happens. So, the next act in the play, we see the son returning home. And he gets up, he starts off. And it says, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. What does that say about the father? Okay, he's looking. Okay, that is an interesting point. He let the son go. As far as we know from the story Jesus tells, he wasn't, sneaking around and renting a place next door and seeing what the son is doing, or sending the other son there, or sending slaves there to keep tabs on him. He allowed him to go his own way. This father, I think it's obvious, realize this son needs some kind of an attitude adjustment here. And so you're right. He lets him go. He doesn't follow him. He doesn't spy on him. But every day he gets up and he looks out the window. He looks over the horizon, down the road, wondering and hoping that he's going to see his son come walking down that road. And finally, this one day, that's what happens. And the father, it says, ran and embraced him and kissed him. So we see the father here rushing to the son, showing really total emotional abandonment, if you will. Goes to him and just embraces him, kisses him, shows affection for him. And the son, in verse 21, starts to lay out his restitution plan. Here's what my proposal is for you, Father. I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, he says. He realizes he's done wrong. He's made some bad, very bad decisions. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father doesn't even let him get to his ultimate proposal. Make me one of your hired men. The father says, no. He says to his slaves, get the best robe and put on him, put a ring on his hand, sandals on his feet, bring the fattened calf, kill it, let's eat and celebrate. So the father says, you're back in, you're my son. The father doesn't demand restitution. Back in those days, if somebody violated the community mores, then the rabbis said that there had to be some kind of restitution. You just couldn't come back and apologize and say, oops, I'm sorry, shouldn't have done that, and be welcomed back into the community. The typical arrangement would be that there would have to be some restitution. There would have to be some payback for violating the community standards. But the father here, again, this would be shocking to the people that were there. The father doesn't demand that, and the way in which the father acts here would be totally contrary to what most fathers of that day, you know, heads of the family, heads of the estate, would have done. They wouldn't have shown this kind of emotion. They wouldn't have run to their son. I mean, children might run, or others, slaves might run if you commanded them to do something, but the head of the household, the father, would not run. I mean, can you imagine this stately-looking man running in his long robes? It just was not something that was done. It was just out of character. But this father does that. This father is a different kind of father. And this father welcomes back the son, and they begin to celebrate. Now notice in verse 22, as we read, that this son, you know, has been in dire straits, been working in the hog pen. He obviously doesn't have shoes anymore if he had them when he left. His clothes are probably in tatters, filthy. And the father doesn't say, go clean up. He just says, get a robe, the best robe, and put on him. Whose robe would that be, by the way? The father's robe. Get the best robe and put on him. Put a ring on his hand. That's a sign of authority and of ownership and of status, and put sandals on his feet. So again, obviously, he didn't have any. And so the father doesn't demand that he do anything, recognizes that his son has learned an important lesson and welcomes him back into the family. And it's interesting here in verse 24, he says, for this son of mine was dead, he's talking to the servants, and has come to life again, and he was lost and has been found. So the father recognizes, just as the son had recognized, that the way in which the son had conducted his life was wrong. He was lost. He was dead, spiritually, or dead to the family in this parable. And so both the father and the son knew that. You know, the father wasn't just overcome with emotion and ignored the son's bad deeds. He recognized, this son of mine was dead, come to life again. He was lost and has now been found. So the celebration is about this change of heart of the son, this recognition by the son that, boy, I was living in a wrong way, and now I want back in the family. I want the father's respect and love again. I didn't think I wanted it, but I do. Well, let's talk a little application before we move on to the rest of the parable. Who do you think the father represents in this parable? Again, a parable is a story that Jesus is giving in order to teach a spiritual lesson. It's a story that would be set in, you know, in terms of things that people would be familiar with, although, as we've seen, some of the elements here would have been surprising or even shocking to those that heard it. But it's a physical story intended to teach a spiritual lesson. So, I don't think it's a real story. I think this is a parable that Jesus made up, and to teach a lesson. I mean, it could have been a real story, but I don't really get the indication of that here, and particularly because this is not the way that a father would have acted at that time, and so really, it's shocking in terms of what the father does here, both in terms of letting the son have his way and then welcoming the son back without restitution. So I think it's a fictional story. But let's talk about who do you think the father represents in this parable?
God did allow them to make those choices and decisions and live with the consequences, but always took them back. But again, sometimes there was restitution, but a majority of the time he took them back and said, you need to follow what I have given you.
Okay. So yeah, the father in this parable represents God. And I think that's very obvious. What about the younger son? Who do you think that person in this story represents? Israel, okay. Well, let's look at the context here a little bit, because I think it actually tells us. This is a Jewish setting, but it's a particular context that Jesus is dealing with here. Go back to the beginning of chapter 15, and we get, I think, which is really the context here. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And then Jesus goes on to tell a couple of parables. There's a parable of a man who had 100 sheep, and he loses one, and he leaves the 99, and he goes searching for the one. He tells another parable about the lost coin. A woman who had 10 silver coins loses one in her house. She sweeps the house, finally finds it, and then they have a celebration about that. Same with the lost sheep when it's found. And then we have this parable of the prodigal son. And by the way, in Luke here, Luke's gospel, this is the only place where we find this particular parable. In Matthew, we find the parable of the lost sheep, but the lost coin, the two sons parable, Luke is the only place where we find this. So it appears to me that this younger son is a representative of the sinners and tax gatherers that Jesus was eating with. They were people who had gone off the deep end, if you will. They had abandoned their relationship with God. They were living in a way that was sinful, that was contrary to God's law. The tax collectors were known for being dishonest, for collecting too much, you know, more than they were supposed to, and pocketing the rest. And so these were characters in that society that would have been seen as younger brothers, if you will, sort of junior members of society that had really degraded themselves through sin and had gone away from God the Father, if you will. And so what we have represented here then is a story of sinners who had recognized they were in the wrong place and were wanting to come back and have fellowship with God again. And they were being open to listening to Jesus as the Son of God. Jesus was coming. Jesus was teaching them. They were associating with him and Jesus with them. And that brought criticism from the Pharisees and the scribes, saying, well, you know, why are you associating with those people, those sinners? And Jesus was being criticized for that. In other places, we find Jesus saying what? When he's questioned about, why are you, you know, associating with these people? Okay. Yeah. It's not the well that need a physician, it's the sick. And I've come to seek those who are lost, not the righteous. So, Jesus then, it's interesting to me that Jesus is so attractive to these people. People who realized when they heard Jesus and the truth of what he was teaching, that were humble enough to turn around and say, you know, I'm in the wrong place. I need to return to God. I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to listen to Jesus. I'm going to come back from where I've been and be part of the family again, if you will. So I think that's what's going on here in the first part, the first act, if you will, of the parable, that Jesus is showing how welcoming God is to people who, despite what they've done in the past, despite how far they may have gone away from God, they are willing to humble themselves and to come back. They finally realized that they're not in the right place, and they want to come back, and God will welcome them. And God will not require them to pay back what they've done, the damage that they've done. They're simply allowed back into the family. And so we find that very loving, generous, as we said, emotional sort of response from the Father to those who are in that situation. Well, you know, just a little more application here of that particular principle. A lot of people in the world are in that situation. Sometimes people that have maybe grown up in the church, they may go away to college, they may go away to a distant city somewhere where they're out of the influence of their normal family and friends, maybe fellow Christians who help them, you know, keep going in the right direction. And they may go off in a direction that they shouldn't go. That's not an unusual thing. And so, you know, a lot of people can relate to this sort of a story that Jesus is giving here. Let's move on to the second act of the story here that Jesus gives about the older son. And again, this is a story not just about the younger son, but about the older son. Verse 25, as we read, there's this older son. He's been out working in the field, and he comes in. He hears music. You know, he hears some kind of celebration going on in the house. He calls one of the servants. What's going on here? He says, oh, your younger brother, he's come back. And, you know, your father has welcomed him, and we're having this celebration because he's returned and he's safe and sound. What was the older son's response to that news? Okay.
It's not like he was up on a pedestal. He was
right.
Doing physical work himself. So,
okay.
You know, he's probably very upset, not only because his brother came back and was having a big celebration, but his eyes came in from a hard day's work. And,
okay.
You know,
that's a very good observation. Here's this older son, the privileged son, if you will, who would get the double portion of the inheritance normally. And he's been around the whole time. While the younger brother went off, blew all this money, did all this bad stuff, he's been hanging around the estate. He's been working. In fact, on the day when, as you point out, when the younger son comes back, he comes in from the field. He's been working in the field. And here's this celebration going on for this younger son who, you know, had done all these bad things. So it says he became angry. He just got mad. Why do you suppose he got mad? What's to be mad about? Why wouldn't he be happy that the younger son has come back? Okay. We can see in later in the conversation with the father here some of the things that he brings up. You know, he talks about how I've been around here, I've been working hard, and, you know, this isn't fair. You know, this guy went off and he did all these terrible things. He blew all your money, and I've just been working hard, and you give him this special party, and me, you don't give anything. You know, you never even given me a goat in order to have a party with my friends, and you kill the fattened calf. The fattened calf, of course, would be the choicest meat. It was a delicacy, something very expensive normally. And so this older son feels that this just is not fair. This is not right. The father's giving special treatment to this bad son in his mind. And I'm sure when the younger son went away, you know, the older son was aware of that and was thinking, you know, this terrible person. Jen. Okay. That's an excellent point because, you know, As we said at the beginning, the father has taken the estate. He sold off part of it, a third of it, given the money to the younger son. That younger son's gone off and he's blown that money. It's gone. It's gone. It's not coming back. And the older son, who has been hanging around doing his job, you know, to keep the farm going, he is thinking in terms of, well, I'm going to inherit this farm someday. I'm not going to get, you know, anywhere by demanding my inheritance early. But you know, I'll keep working. I'll keep doing the father's will. And when my father finally passes away, I'll inherit my two-thirds, because the two-thirds is still there, at least. And so this younger son coming back, he's welcomed into the family. That's going to be at the expense, ultimately, of who? This older son. So he's thinking, man, not only is this unfair the way the father's treating me, but this is going to cost me. This is going to hit me in the wallet. This is not fair from that standpoint either. Yeah, Mary Martha. Okay. That is very true. Neither of these young men here have earned what they would be getting. That's one ultimate lesson I think we can learn from the parable as we're thinking in spiritual application terms, that they were going to inherit something that ultimately was provided by the Father, was generated by the Father. And yeah, they had a part in maintaining the farm, if you will, but it still was the Father's goods that they were getting, and one wanted to get the Father's goods just early and without regard to the Father's feelings or respect for the Father. The other thought, well, I'll hang around and I'll earn my way into this inheritance. I'll stick around, I'll be the good son, I'll get the good stuff. So, in a way, the two sons are really, they're both in need of an attitude adjustment. They're both after the father's stuff, ultimately, and not really thinking in terms of a relationship with the father, the kind of relationship the father wanted anyway. Joseph. Trying to go get it in a different way than the younger son did. The younger son just demanded it. This other son thinks, in essence, I'll just do what I need to do in order to get it. But let's go now and look at particular, starting in the end of verse 28 into verse 29, this conversation between the father and the older son. So in verse 28 it says the older son was angry, was not willing to go in. He says, I'm not going into that party for this young whippersnapper, this bad son. So he's standing outside. You can just imagine him with his arms crossed out there. And it says the father came out and began pleading with him. So the father comes out and tries to reason with this older son. Notice the answer that the older son gives. He answered and said to his father, look. Is that a very respectful way to talk to your father? No. It's not saying, sir. It's not saying, even father. It's just saying, look, you. You know, it's a very disrespectful way to address one's father, particularly at that time. Says, for so many years I have been serving you. I have never neglected a command of yours, he says. Is that really true? Has he done everything perfect? Probably not. But that's the way he sees himself. That's what he's focused on in order to get the father's goods eventually. That's what he's after in his mind. That's what he's thinking. And yet you have never given me a young goat. So he gives this pitch about, you know, this isn't fair. You haven't treated me the same as you've treated this son, and he's been bad and I've been good. And in verse 30, but when this son of yours, notice how he refers to his brother, doesn't say my brother, this son of yours, when he goes out and he does what he did, he's wasted all of your wealth with prostitutes and so forth, kill the fatted calf for him. You celebrate him, and you know you haven't treated me that way. So obviously this older son is taking this very personally. He's not looking at the big picture, thinking about this younger son that, yeah, he was off, he was doing bad things. The father acknowledged that. And now he's back. Isn't that great? No, he's thinking in terms of, well, how does this affect me, or how does this make me feel? And it doesn't make me feel very good. And so he's angry, he won't go in. Verse 31, and he, the father, said to him, son, again, addressing him very, very tenderly here, son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. So he reinforces that, I love you, son. You know, your relationship with me is what I want, and you're in the household. You have been doing right. Verse 32, but we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours, remember he said this son of yours, he says, this brother of yours, the father coming back, was dead and has begun to live, was lost and has been found. And interestingly, that's where the parable ends. Jesus doesn't say, you know, what happens after that. Did the older son finally say, you know, Father, you're right. I need to look at the bigger picture. And I'll go in and you know, I'll celebrate this. And I'll, you know, it'll be at my expense ultimately having this younger son come back, but that's okay because he's back in the family and we all love him. We all want the best for him. Is that what happened? Did the family come back together in unity and all of that? We don't know. Jesus just leaves that as a cliffhanger, if you will. He just leaves that open. Joseph.
He's very happy. He's very rejoicing when we come back. And as a brother, you know, having a brother, if you know John went and just spent 6 months in Germany not doing whatever, you know, and doing things he's not supposed to, he comes back and we throw a big party. I can understand the sensory jealousy, you know, because well, where's this special attention? What's interesting is you know the father is looking at it from you know it could have been worse. He could have stayed there. It could have been a worse situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's happy just that he's back because his brother is very jealous.
Yeah. One thing I'll just toss in here about the younger son is that he did have the good fortune of having misfortune when he was going wrong. You know, if everything had gone well when he went off and was doing all sorts of wrong things, he might have continued in that. It was his misfortune and his having to face the consequences of that, getting down to a desperate state, that led him, led to his change of heart. And that, as I'm sure, I mean, as I've recognized, you probably recognize the same thing. People don't tend to change, even though it's obvious to them even that they need to, until they get to that desperate point. And that's what happened to the younger son, fortunate for him in this story. But let's make just a little application then of, this part about the older son, and then we'll wrap it up. Who do you think the older son represents in this parable? Okay, we go back to the beginning of the chapter, and that's really the two sets of people that Jesus is talking about. He's talking to the tax gatherers and the sinners, and he's talking to the Pharisees and the scribes. And From what it says at the beginning of the chapter, the Pharisees and the scribes were criticizing Jesus for associating with these people. You're welcoming them. You're eating with them. You're associating with them. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, that's that. If you were from God, that would be above you, sort of a thing. And obviously that's not how Jesus viewed the people who needed repentance, who needed God ultimately. So yes, Jesus is really, and I think this is really the main point of the parable. Jesus is talking to the Pharisees and the scribes and trying to get them to see themselves in this story. And again, we're left with a cliffhanger. We don't know whether they, well, I guess we do know from other passages that many of them did not get the message. Many of the scribes and Pharisees did not have a change of heart. But Jesus gives them a very tender appeal, you might say, here in trying to reach their hearts. And, you know, they were upset with Jesus for associating with these people because to them that was wrong. You shouldn't associate with people that are doing wrong. And by the way, doesn't Paul say in 1 Corinthians that evil companions corrupt good morals? So, I mean, aren't the scribes and Pharisees right here? Should Jesus be associating with these people? Okay.
Position of those that are well don't.
We all have relationships with people in the world who maybe don't care about God or who aren't paying attention to God's will. But, you know, if we can have a positive influence on them, if we influence them rather than them influencing us, then we're doing what Jesus did. We're showing them the value of a relationship with God, with Christ, and that can help them then see where they need to go. Yeah, Steve.
Who left and squandered their wealth in return. They weren't the people who were out still feeding, you know, living that licentious life. So I don't think if they were continuing and, you know, wanting to pursue their sin, Jesus may not have been eating with them, but because they're the ones who returned.
Well, I think actually this is pretty early in their return, if you will, that a lot of them probably had not made the full switch yet. Jesus was obviously giving this parable to them as well to encourage them to continue to come. But you're right, they were moving in the right direction, and Jesus was having that influence on them rather than the other way around. Sometimes we can get in a position where, you know, we're running with people and doing things that they do that we shouldn't be doing, and that can be a bad situation. Sue, did you have a... Go ahead. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, so Jesus, Mike. Such were some of you. Yeah. Right. So yeah, we need to think in terms of our relationship with people of the world, of how we can help them, how we can influence them, how we can help them to see what the younger son in this story saw, the ultimate value of having a relationship with the Father. But another lesson, yeah.
The eternal attitude of God in that he loves mercy over sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Now the Pharisees were certainly willing to give sacrifices and bind upon everybody the rituals and the demands that they had determined. But this is another example that God loves mercy, wants mercy over sacrifice.
Right. And that definitely is one of the messages that Jesus is sending to the scribes and Pharisees who are sitting there listening. They are thinking in terms of we're doing pretty good here. We're really our own saviors from the standpoint of we're doing right. We're in God's good graces because of our good actions is what they're thinking. And our sacrifices, yeah. Right. So they're thinking in terms of, here's our service, that's an equivalent to God giving us blessings and ultimately, eternal life. One message that Jesus is trying to get across here loud and clear to them is no. That, you know, the younger son thought he could be his own savior, his own Lord, by going off and doing his own thing. These people think, the scribes and Pharisees think, they can be their own savior and their own Lord by their own goodness. And it was their, you know, it was the good acts of the younger son that made him mad at the bad acts and ultimately the person of the younger son. They saw themselves, or he saw himself, as superior, as in God, in the Father's good graces because of the good things that he had done. Jesus wants them to see that, no, that's not how it is. You know, there is no room in a child of God, a place in the heart of a child of God for arrogance or self-sufficiency or self-righteousness. Those kinds of things, you know, are not what save us. We ultimately all, just like everybody, regardless of how bad or how, quote, good they have been, we're all dependent on the grace of God. We're not going to be saved without it, and that's what the ultimate message, I think, that God or that Jesus is trying to give here to the Pharisees who had separated themselves from others and saw themselves as superior, treated those other people with contempt. And if that sounds familiar, Jesus gave another parable about the publican and the Pharisee that focuses on that very point. But let's bring it down then and close for tonight. We're a little bit over time. I apologize for that, but I appreciate all the comments. So think in terms of how should the elder brother here have responded? He responded with anger, didn't want to go in. He's upset. We don't know ultimately how the story turns out. But, you know, if he was a true elder brother, what would he have done? He would have been happy that this younger brother now is back. He's back on course. He's back in the family. He's going to have a relationship with this person again. Ultimately, that's what he should have, what should have been his attitude. In fact, if he was a real elder brother, while the younger son was off and in trouble, the elder brother might have, or perhaps should have, gone and searched him out and tried to encourage him to come back. Maybe at the older son's own expense. And that would be a real good brother, to do something for a younger brother that's gone off the rails, so to speak, to try to bring him back. But, you know, that would be a good older brother, but this older brother wasn't like that. Jesus gives us here a, if you will, a bad elder brother. And ultimately, of course, Jesus is our elder brother from the standpoint of he left his home. He came to this earth. He died, he sacrificed at great cost to himself to restore us to relationship with God. He was stripped of his clothes as he was being crucified so that we could have that royal robe of the Father put on our shoulders. So Jesus is the epitome of what an older brother should be. And that's why we can appreciate him so much, those of us that know and trust in him. So tonight, let's close just to invite anyone who needs to obey the gospel to realize that God, you know, if you're away from God, you're not where you should be, God is waiting. He wants you to come back. He loves you. He's looking at the horizon, hoping and waiting for you to come. And you have this opportunity now to do that if we can stand and sing together.